Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Our week in review begins with, what else? The big race to be Boston's next mayor. This week, the field of candidates shrunk from 12 to 2.
State Rep Marty Walsh finished first, but he reminded his supporters to keep up the fight till November.
Tonight's a great start, but it's only a start. We've got so much more to do in the next 6 weeks, and we're going to get there.
Also on the November ballot, City Councilor John Connolly, who finished a very close runner-up.
I have never been so glad to be in second place in my life.
Plus, this week's repeal of the tech tax has Republicans in a Massachusetts state house gloating.
We will welcome others to the table today in making that correction.
Also, East Boston alone will vote on a casino proposal, and Mike Capuano is out of the governor's race.
We plan to cover all of that with our Week in Review panel. Joining us now are Paul McMorrow here in the studio. He's associate editor at Commonwealth Magazine. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
And also Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Peter, Paul, welcome to both of you.
Hi, everybody.
So let's go straight to the Boston mayor's race. You know, this at least the preliminary with the 12 candidates, was relatively cordial, even very harmonious. These people know each other, like each other, play sports together. Got a little testy this week between Connolly and Walsh over the outside funding issue, which we'll get to. But, you know, these two men, Walsh and Connolly, are on the surface somewhat similar. I'm wondering what the two of you expect from this race in the next 6 weeks. What are we going to see? What are we going to see? Paul, would you start us off?
The interesting thing is that both of them, if you look at where the votes came from, a lot of them were very close to home. John Connolly drawing heavily from the west side of the city, and Marty Walsh on the east side. And what's left and what they're going to be fighting over is this great middle, Dorchester, Roxbury, and Jamaica Plain and the downtown. And it's going to be interesting to see how each of them, culturally, they're not great fits for those neighborhoods, and culturally, how they try to pivot to capture those votes.
And Peter Kanellis?
I actually think that they're not as similar as people might say. I mean, because we had six minority candidates and six white candidates, there's a lot of their two Irish American guys from the city. But they actually have very, very different personas. I mean, Marty Walsh is somebody who's come out of the labor movement, who's pitches himself as kind of an up by the bootstrap son of Dorchester. And you have John Connolly, who's the son of a judge and a former Secretary of State of Massachusetts, who went to private schools and had a more privileged background and positions himself as sort of a candidate of New Boston. So I think that there are real differences there. And I think that the conventional wisdom, at least starting off, is that Connolly has a little more room to grow in terms of appealing to downtown voters, you know, people who might have voted for Mike Ross or John Barros or somebody like that. He also has done a little bit more of an outreach, at least getting started for this race, towards the black community because of his alliance with Ayanna Pressley, and he'll rely a lot on her, I think, to try to build bridges to Roxbury and some of the black communities. So it'll be a very interesting race. I'm not making any predictions, but I do think Connolly's a little more poised to grow.
We had on Radio Boston a live show in Copley Square this Wednesday. We were set up on Boylston Street outside the Boston Public Library. We had John Connolly with us in person and Marty Walsh with us by phone from the State House. He had to be there because he was voting on the tech tax repeal. But one of the things I asked John Connolly was that on preliminary night after results had come in, I noticed a tweet go out that said, "When will the attack ads begin?" So I asked John about that, and he said he hopes that the general election will avoid negative campaigning. Marty Walsh later that day said the same thing.
And I've never engaged in negative campaigning. I don't believe in it. I think the people of Boston deserve better than that. And I look forward to a very good, spirited debate in some points, but a campaign that's going to be very good up above board.
But the very next day, things got a little testy. Connolly called on Walsh to limit outside money from the race, and Walsh rejected that out of hand.
This is political theater from a candidate that came in second place. On this issue, I do not trust them.
And here's what Connolly had to say about that.
I'm disappointed that he attacked my character, but if we signed a pledge like this, there are penalties built in if the rules are broken. Again, we ought to be talking about schools, we ought to be talking about jobs, we ought to be talking about public safety. And the best way to do that is make sure the outside money doesn't warp this debate.
Paul McMorrow, what does this tell you about what tone may be like over the next 6 weeks?
I think the elbows are getting a little sharper, and we're 6 weeks out, so that there's room for him to get sharper still. I thought the other interesting thing that Marty Walsh said yesterday was calling John Connolly a corporate lawyer, in addition to somebody who came in second. So he's not only a loser, but a corporate lawyer.
Said as sort of an epithet.
Yes, neither one of those are said nicely, I think.
And Peter Kanellis, on the issue of outside money, how much ultimately do you expect to see in this race, and how will it affect the race?
Well, I think that Connolly is trying to stop it right now because he feels like there's outside labor money that's going to come in and support Walsh, and Walsh is obviously opposing the People's Pledge or saying it's a gimmick because he feels like he's entitled to that support. It's quite depressing, actually, to hear those two sound bites that you had right there, because, boy, did they ever sound like garden variety politicians, and we were so free of that in the preliminary election. So I certainly would call on both of them to clean up their act quickly and try to go for a more high-minded tone.
I also want to get both of your thoughts on the relatively low voter turnout. What, something in the 25% range, even for a race that was really momentous for Boston. I'm wondering what you think accounts for that.
I think that we've had two decades where there hasn't been much competition on the municipal level, and I think you've seen Mayor Mineno's power grow basically inverse to the degree to which people care about municipal politics, and it might be that it takes a little bit of time to ramp that back up. You know, you've seen solid participation for governor's races and for presidentials, and it may be take some work making the case to younger residents in Boston who have come in over the past 20 years that municipal politics actually matters, and that's a case that has to be made.
Peter, do you have a different take on that?
No, I have sort of the same take, but I'm a little more upset about it, I think, than Paul is, in that we do believe that Boston's a different place than it's been 20 years ago, but clearly our political institutions haven't caught up, and part of the blame is the voters themselves, who may be disengaged, and younger voters who don't think the municipal government has anything to do with them, but there's plenty of reason why it does. But also there's not a lot of organizing in certain areas, and there's rampant organizing in other areas, and that's something that smart candidates will have to correct in the future.
Gentlemen, let me follow up on something you said. Peter, I think you just used the term the high-minded tone of this preliminary election and campaign. And I just wanted to get you both to comment about this, because it really was, to my mind, really, really impressive. We had all these guys in here for interviews. We heard great discussions about education, schools, development, jobs, with so little acrimony and sort of useless back and forth, it really rates as one of the more substantive campaigns I think I've ever observed. Peter, do you want to say more about that? Was that your take?
That was certainly my take, and I think the candidates deserve a lot of credit for it. I think there were some outside factors that contributed, such as no obvious front runner starting off. Mm. If there were somebody who was at 30 or 40% in the polls, they would be, you know, attacked to kind of bring them down. And they'd also be the subject of more vetting from the media, and so there'd be more stray questions about people's personal finances and that kind of stuff, which can really turn off voters. So I think that we were very fortunate that 12 candidates came in on more or less of an equal footing and behaved generally well. And I do give the candidates credit, because even within that, you know, 12 equals, there were people who were fighting over the same constituencies and probably could have accrued some benefit from bringing down one or the other of their challengers and really didn't do it.
Paul, was that your take, more or less?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting to watch, you know, during the televised debate. The candidates were basically begged, you know, please take a shot at one another, and instead they were leaping to each other's defense, and it was a great thing to watch. And apparently things are different in the final.
I'd like to also follow up just a little bit on this this idea that despite the wealth of minority candidates, the final race is between two white Irish guys. And Peter, I take your point that these guys aren't so similar in many ways. We asked John Barros about this. He was a candidate who didn't make the cut this week, and the former executive director of the Dudley Street Initiative. Here's what he had to say.
We have two candidates that, because of the election process, with 12 of us in it, are now talking about different parts of Boston and different issues than they started with.
And Barros went on to talk about, I mean, for example, they were talking about public safety in neighbors like Mattapan. So the point there, the minority candidates, which included Barros, Felix Arroyo, Charlotte Golar-Ritchie, among others, did change the conversation around a host of issues. Peter, do you agree with that?
I agree with that. I think, though, that one thing that marked the preliminary campaign is that there was kind of consensus on what the major issues were, and there was almost a consensus on which way to go on a lot of them that came about. The biggest misconception, I think, about this issue is when people look at it and say, well, the two white guys won, is that, you know, the white neighborhoods were somehow posed against the minority neighborhoods. There may have been some identity politics involved in the voting, but there wasn't substantial disagreement about the policies. And so, yes, it's two white guys squaring off, but I think that the issues that they're going to be discussing take full account of minority voters.
Paul, what did you make of the Reverend Eugene Rivers, this argument? He ended up on the front page of the Boston Herald, I think just yesterday. He talked about a failure of black political organizers and elected leaders to exhibit the political leadership required to craft an electoral strategy that would advance the interests of their community. Is that a fair criticism there? What do you make of that?
It was a bizarre criticism coming from a guy who had endorsed a white guy from Southie against a Haitian American, now state senator.
This is the St. Patrick's Day breakfast
from Dorchester. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, he had endorsed Nick Collins against Linda Dorsey-Nefori.
Oh, right.
And months later, he's wagging his finger at other candidates for not jumping out of the race. I mean, it doesn't, logically it doesn't hold, but I guess that's never stopped anyone before.
Yeah. Peter, though, I mean, this idea that somehow the black community should have coalesced early around one candidate.
Well, I think that there was it's a very tough issue for any community, and I think that given some of the historic racial sense of exclusion in the black community, it would be particularly hard to tell black candidates to get out so that black folk could coalesce around one candidate. Nonetheless, I think that there might have been some wisdom in that. I mean, if you look at it, just two candidates, Charles Yancey, who was also running for the city council. So I don't think he was that serious a mayoral candidate. He was just kind of, it was a bit of a vanity run for Charles Yancey. And Charles Clements, who did contribute a lot to the debate, but at a certain point after contributing to the debate could have ducked out. Those two candidates together, if you took their vote and gave it to Charlotte Golar Richie, she would have been in the finals. So I'm not sure that Gene's wrong on this, but I also agree with Paul that he's doing a bit of grandstanding here.
On the other hand, Peter, in the Herald today, Peter Galtzinis talked about this topic, and he said, and I'm quoting him, he said, "How do you tell bright, committed candidates of color to sit down and forget about competing for the first open mayor's race in 20 years?" So do you think it was really fair or realistic to ask?
The key there is the bright, committed candidates. Yeah. I think John Barrows was a very bright, committed candidate and probably should have, I mean, we endorsed him. We felt like he should have been in the final race. And he's outstanding. He's just outstanding. The two that you might have prevailed on were Charles Clements, who is a good guy and who contributed a lot to the debate and all of that, but realistically had no chance to win and had to know it himself. And Yancey, who was already hedging his bets and was kind of half in, half out. So, maybe you could have made the case to those two, who are honorable people, who are committed to black political empowerment, who might have seen the wisdom. And if they didn't, they should stay in the race. But, Gene Rivers is saying is that maybe some community leaders could have tried to make that case.
Sure. I'm wondering what the two of you think about what ultimately is the impact of a lack of minority candidate in this final race. Is anything lost? I mean, is there any perhaps voter disillusionment among minority voters who might think, why should I bother to vote in the election? Is there any discouragement among future minority candidates? Paul, what's your take?
Two things. First, John Conley's main issue through this whole campaign has been education, and that's something that matters as much in Dudley Square, where, by the way, he held his preliminary night victory party. Something that matters as much in Dudley as it does in West Roxbury. The other thing is with two candidates from separate neighborhoods, but ethnically representing the same tribe, they're both going to have to tack toward where the vacuum is, which is black votes. And you've seen John Connolly and Marty Walsh both start to make very strong overtures. And I think the absence of a minority candidate means that these two white guys are going to have to play outside their zone.
Peter?
I think that when people talk about the face of Boston, to some extent, the mayor is an ambassador for the city outside of Boston. And I think that having somebody who, looks different than previous Boston mayors would have signaled something of a fresh image, a fresh start and all that. And so there would have been a real benefit in that. It's not, I don't think that's the sole reason people should be voting for mayor at all, or the most important issue or anything like that. But when you're asking what we're missing by not having a minority candidate in the finals, we're missing sort of the chance to visibly change the image of the city.
A question about the union affiliations of these two guys. Unions feel very strongly about them. For the most part, they're quite champions of Marty Walsh, who, of course, is a former labor executive. The BTU in particular very much dislikes John Connolly because of his pledge to basically drastically revamp the school system, you know, trim jobs at 26 Court Street, school department headquarters. How do you think each of them takes advantage of their stances with unions, and how do they keep it from being, make it a liability, keep it, make it a benefit, keep it from being a liability? Paul McMorrow?
The most interesting thing to me is that the BTU, the teachers union, has no obvious friend in this race unless Marty Walsh suddenly decides to tack in their direction.
But now he's an ed reform supporter for the most part.
Yeah, he has been. He's been on the board of a charter school. He has he did not encounter a friendly room at the teachers union hall when they had their forum. And so if you take the teachers off the table, what you're really talking about with labor is contracts for firefighters and police officers.
And Peter, a question actually. I mean, when Marty Walsh gets basically painted as a union guy, does he deserve more nuance than that?
He certainly does. I mean, he is. He's been a long-serving state representative, and he has taken positions that are not associated with union positions. He was a very progressive leader of one of the more progressive, admirable unions out there, the Building Trades Union. So I don't think by any means he's worthy of being stereotyped. On the other hand, it's a huge issue for any mayor is handling the contracts with city workers. And the city has very, very powerful unions. And there's a big difference between the public sector unions, which are dealing with the city, and the private sector unions, which is where Walsh came from, where the private sector unions are essentially looking at an industry and saying, you know, you're making this much profit, therefore we deserve this much of a raise. You know, you have to cut labor in. We have to collaborate. We're in this together. A little bit different with the city and their unions. Because the money that there's no baseline profit or something like that to compare it to. So the question is just what's fair. And the teachers, the firefighters, the police will want the sky. And if Marty Walsh is perceived as their champion going in and that they delivered this to him, that's a reason for people to be concerned. It's also a reason for Walsh to distance himself from that perception as much as possible, and I'm sure that he will. On the other hand, there's also a risk for Connolly, a serious risk for Connolly, if he's going to try to be that new Boston downtown candidate. If he's expressing something that feels like disrespect for city workers, who are a huge force in the electorate, or people who really like firefighters, for example, you know, why would John Connolly not respect firefighters? He's actually gone he's gone out of his way to be mild on the firefighters. So there's risk in it for Connolly as well.
So lots of focus on the mayor's race for good reason. But there were other candidates on the ballot. Tuesday's preliminary race for Boston City Council had 19 at-large candidates. And we should mention a few emerging names that are getting a fair amount of attention. Among them, Michelle Wu, dynamic young Asian-American candidate. Josh Zakim, son of the legendary religious and civil rights leader in Boston. He hopes to succeed Mike Ross, who's now out of a job because he wasn't a mayoral finalist. Paul, what's your take on these ballot races, on these races a little farther down the ballot?
The at-large race has been really interesting, and I think because it cuts against the this perception of what we were just talking about in terms of minority representation, two very strong women of color who have the potential to go 1-2 on the at-large ballot, frankly. I think it shows, one, that the city is much more diverse than the mayoral final ticket would have you believe, and two, I think it shows that if you it shows to future mayoral candidates that if you organize the right way and you do the outreach to the right constituencies, you can do quite well. Mm.
Peter, I'm reminded of your editorial sort of about the depth of the political talent in Boston. I'm wondering if what Paul was referring to sort of is a reference to that as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a very, very competitive political environment. And so people like Michelle Wu, who's both of you were referring to, you know, is already getting national attention. I mean, I was at a wedding in New Orleans, and there were national political people there who were asking about Michelle Wu. That's what they were asking about. They're preparing her presidential run for 2026 or whatever. But I mean, it's because Massachusetts does have a sort of outsized national footprint in politics, and because these candidates are so ready for prime time. And in the case of Michelle Wu, she's somebody who's perceived as having an organizing background, but she's also a Harvard Law School grad. She's also, representing an up-and-coming community. She's very close to Elizabeth Warren. I mean, extremely close to Elizabeth Warren. It seems a real protege of Elizabeth Warren. So she's already on the launching pad, and that's true of many other people who've emerged in this campaign.
Quick question on the governor's race as well. The update there is that Congressman Mike Capuano says he will not run for governor. So I'm interested in your takes on the field so far. How do you see this shaping up, Paul?
For Mike Capuano, I guess losing to Martha Coakley once was a mouth already. but it's fascinating. Transitioning from 8 years of Deval Patrick, you have a field that is not very high on charisma on either the Democratic or the Republican side.
And Peter Kanellis?
On the governor's race?
Yeah.
I think, with politics all the time here, I think that Capuano, there was reason to doubt Capuano's commitment to this race to begin with, so it's not a shock that he's pulling out. I think that there actually is a varied group of sort of Deval Patrick wannabes who are running in the Democratic race. The question there is whether they'll be overshadowed by Steve Grossman and Martha Coakley, who are very credentialed figures who are preparing very traditional runs for governor.
Another bit of news this week is that the vote has happened and the residents of East Boston only will get to decide whether there will be a casino in Boston, particularly in Suffolk Downs. Paul, feel like this is a good deal for the rest of the city that doesn't get to weigh in?
I don't, no.
Simple as that.
Yeah, because I think from a financial impact, the multipliers in terms of where the money for a casino comes from, where that is shifted from elsewhere inside the economy. It doesn't come from East Boston only. It comes from the whole city. It comes from the surrounding communities. And the impacts are regional.
Hmm. So time is running out. We have just enough time for our hubbubs, those little stories plucked out of the memory hole by our panelists. Peter, let's start with you. Your hubbub for this week.
Glenn James, the homeless man who found a backpack full of cash and returned it.
Great story.
This is a great story. It is a great story. And it's very interesting in that it kind of elicited a reaction that was a little bit similar to that which some of the Boston Marathon bombing victims faced, which is people wanting to give him money. And he raised more than $100,000 online of people. And that is a wonderful kind of expression of generosity. And it's a well-deserved tribute to somebody's character, in this case, Glenn James. But there's something also a little bit troubling about this trend where very sympathetic stories become very, very lucrative sources of donations. You know, people should remember also that if you really want to help the homeless, there are many charities out there to help them.
Mm. Good point. Paul, your hubbub.
I wrote a column for Peter this week calling for the demolition of Boston City Hall. And if you read the letters page this week, met with universal dismissal. Glad to have brought out the fact this week that Boston City Hall is universally loved, apparently. but the interesting thing from the reaction has been sharp criticism of City Hall Plaza, and I think number one on, or if not number one, very high on the to-do list of the next mayor will be fixing the plaza.
Bringing a little life, maybe a tree or two would be nice.
Some grass.
Or some grass.
Exactly.
Sasha, what about you?
So I want to mention a woman in Canada who she signed up for a half marathon in Ontario. Somehow she made a wrong turn. By the time she realized it, she was sort of closing in on 20 miles. She figured, I'll just keep running 20. When she hit 20, she thought, why don't I just run the full marathon? So she did. She is now qualified for the Boston Marathon as a result of her mistake. So Meredith Fitzmaurice of Ontario will be in the Boston Marathon for her sort of map reading difficulty on the marathon course, a mistake that has worked out nicely for her.
All right. Well, my hubbub is also from the world of sports. It's a tip of the hat to that all-too-rare combination of great athletic accomplishment combined with humility. Karl Yastrzemski, of course, the face of the Impossible Dream Team, last Triple Crown winner, that statue unveiled this week outside of Fenway Park. this guy was so big in Boston. After he retired, he just sort of quietly went off, and I guess he went fishing. He had the class to come back to Boston this week and commend and congratulate the team of 2013. So a rare thing. And then down in New York, the great Mariano Rivera, talk about great athletic accomplishment combined with rare humility. Throwing his last pitch for the New York Yankees, all-time save leader. So, my hubbub, athletic accomplishment and humility. So, that's it. Paul McMorrow, Associate Editor at Commonwealth Magazine, and Peter Canellos, Editorial Page Editor at the Boston Globe. Thank you both. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony. Thanks, Sasha.
Stay with us. Up next, a new public art project in Boston that is putting pianos on the streets. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.